Good afternoon. My name is Ed Howard. I'm with the Alliance for Health Reform. On behalf of Senator Rockefeller and Senator Collins and our board of directors, I want to welcome you to this briefing to examine, I guess you'd call it the proposal to include in health reform legislation a time bomb, a so-called public plan option. No aspect, I think, of the reform debate has generated as much heat as the public plan option. It's either a deal breaker if it's included or a deal breaker if it's not included, either a tool for providing consumers affordable coverage by stimulating competition on the basis of quality and efficiency, or unfair competition for private insurers, and in the extreme, a stalking horse for a single-payer system. Like so much in healthcare reform, agreement stems from what sort of public plan you're talking about and what the other components of reform are. And in order to facilitate our conversation today, one assumption I'd like to suggest that all of our panelists make and that you in the audience keep in your head is that whatever the public option looks like, it's offered alongside private insurance choices in some sort of exchange or connector, some entity that enforces a level of consistent rules on all the plans. And beyond that, I suggest to everybody up here that they be as explicit as they can about what it is you're assuming in the plan that you're either defending or attacking. If I can sort of diverge for a few seconds to do a commercial. You might want to mark your calendars for a Commonwealth Fund Alliance briefing next Monday, specifically on the topic of exchanges. So if you can't get your questions asked about that aspect of this today, keep them and save them for next Monday. And I guess that gets me to the fact that we're pleased to have as a partner and co-sponsor in this briefing, the Commonwealth Fund, which has commissioned or done, or both, some very good analysis of the impact of a public plan option in a reformed healthcare system. A couple of logistical items. Bear with me if you've heard this before. There's an awful lot of material in your packets that includes speaker biographies, more extensive, and not have time to give. You will also find PowerPoint presentations, which are almost exactly like what you're going to see on the screen. There will be a webcast and podcast available tomorrow on KaiserNetwork.org. In a few days, you'll also be able to get a transcript of today's discussion at allhealth.org, our website. And at the appropriate time, I appreciate it if you use those green question cards to ask questions or come to one of the microphones that are there for you to use for purpose and fill out that little evaluation form before you do. So, we have a knowledgeable first group of panelists today. We'll have three presentations from them, and a lot of time for your questions and your comments and interaction among the panelists. And we're going to start with Aaron Davis, who is the president and CEO of Commonwealth Fund. Aaron is a health economist by training, one of the country's leading health policy experts, and the public plan option has been a major item of investigation and analysis of the fund and the Commission on High Performance Health System that the fund has established. And that has all yielded some, I think,
thought-provoking options and recommendations on the idea of a public plan.
Happy to have you with us.
Thanks, Ed, for that lovely introduction and for hosting today's forum. It's exciting to be at a time when health reform is getting serious consideration, and in a context of not just covering the uninsured, as important as that is, but doing so in a way that enhances value for what we spend on healthcare, slowing the growth in healthcare costs, achieving savings that are much needed by employers and by families, and doing so through a transformed health insurance industry and healthcare delivery system that yields an affordable federal budget cost. I'm particularly pleased to talk about the importance of a public health insurance plan in a health insurance exchange as a lever for pulling off these objectives. It builds on a report issued by the Commonwealth Fund called The Path to a High Performance Health System, a 2020 Vision, and the Policies to Pave the Way. Briefly, the overall context of this, what we call PATH report, is that it builds on employer coverage and public programs, so it's a mixed public-private system that achieves health insurance for everyone. It does include a national health insurance exchange, and it offers choices through that exchange. It doesn't require anyone to obtain their coverage that way, but permits employers, if they so choose, to purchase coverage for their employees through the National Health Insurance Exchange. If they do so, it offers an option to workers of a public health insurance plan as well as private plans, and does so in a way that pools risk and reduces administrative costs. Everyone is required to have health insurance coverage. To do that requires making that coverage affordable. Low-income programs are expanded. For example, Medicaid and CHIP cover adults and children up to 150% of the poverty level, and it provides income-related premium assistance to make coverage affordable. Employers are required to share the responsibility for financing coverage. There are insurance market reforms that apply to plans within the exchange, but also any sold outside the exchange, including things like covering everyone regardless of health status and charging the same premium regardless of health status. Very importantly, the plans offered, particularly Medicare, Medicaid, the public health insurance plan, would move to a new system of provider payment that would reward primary care, would encourage people to enroll in patient-centered medical homes, would bundle hospital payment with care for 30 days following discharge, and in so doing, would slow the cost growth over time, sharing savings with providers. Insurers would compete in the exchange on the basis of added value, not on risk selection. I won't spend time on the exchange since Ed mentioned the alliance will focus on that in next week's session, but the important point is that it would improve continuity and choice. For regional health insurance plans, such as Group Health Cooperative in Seattle, Health Partners in Minneapolis, it would permit them to be offered to a wider market. Right now, employers may offer only one plan. They may not be the plan that's offered. So for those getting their coverage through the exchange, it expands the market for private regional plans. It's easy to enroll. You can enroll through the Internet. It's easy to compare plans. It also reduces administrative costs by reducing the need for marketing, eliminating underwriting, and churning, so that when you change your job, if you have coverage through the exchange, go to work for an employer that also permits employees to obtain coverage through the exchange, you can keep your policy with employers switching which employer is responsible for the payment. But how does a public health insurance plan offered through the exchange affect these dynamics? It broadens the foundation for rapid implementation of innovative payment and system reforms, which results in a slower growth in employer premiums. It provides a less expensive way to cover the uninsured, lower administrative costs, and therefore lower the federal budget costs. It expands coverage and choice and continuity. You can make sure there's always an option available. Don't have to worry about private plans pulling out of a geographic area. And it ensures that markets work in the public interest. In many areas, there are only two large insurers. In many areas, there's only one hospital or one large health system. For example, in all but three states, two of the largest health plans control 50% or more of the enrollment. The benefits in the public health insurance plan are modeled on the federal employees' standard option, Blue Cross Blue Shield standard option in federal employees. Most importantly, creating the exchange would reduce administrative costs, particularly for individuals and small businesses. Right now, administrative costs for individuals in the individual market are 41% of the premium. For small businesses, anywhere from 20 to 35% of the premium. In fact, overall, administrative expenses are much higher for those in the small group and individual market. But even with large companies, the top five companies, 17% of the premium goes for administrative overhead and profits, much higher than the rates we experience with public programs such as Medicare and Medicaid. What's the effect of those advantages on premiums offered through the exchange? The public health insurance plan that offers coverage paying providers at Medicare rates would provide family coverage at roughly $9,000 a year, according to estimates prepared for the Commonwealth Fund by the Lewin Group. Without that advantage, the current small firms with average enrollees and the benefits in Blue Cross Blue Shield standard option would be $10,800. There are intermediate options if a public plan were to pay at the same rates as commercial insurers. The premium would still drop by $1,000 for families from $10,800 to $9,800 as a result of the administrative savings and would fall further by another $900 if it were to build on Medicare's payment rates. What difference does that make for total health spending? With a public health insurance plan offered through the exchange, the cumulative savings in total health spending over the period from 2010 to 2020 would be $3 trillion. If this public health insurance plan were offered only to small businesses, thus there would be savings, but $1.5 trillion. But without a public health insurance plan, the savings to the health system from the various payment and system reforms included in this overall proposal would be about $750 billion, substantially less relief. Not surprisingly, as a result, the effect on major payers, on employers, on federal government would be quite different between an exchange with a public health insurance plan and without such an option. Not only to total health system spending, savings decline without a public health insurance plan, the cost to the federal budget goes up from about $600 billion over that period of time to $1.1 trillion. The savings to employers of $230 billion with a public health insurance plan, in fact, turn into a net cost of about $900 billion. So it sketches out at least one practical, pragmatic way of achieving the goals of health reform: coverage for everyone, savings to the health system, slowing the rate of increase in health care costs from 6.7% a year to 5.5% a year, easing the financial burdens on households by about $2 trillion, in fact, about $2,300 per family in the year 2020, significant savings to employers, and substantially lowers the federal budget cost. Thank you.
Great. Thanks very much, Karen. Excuse me. Next, we'll hear from Karen Ignani, who's the president and CEO of America's Health Insurance Plans, AHIP, whose members are the private health insurance plans that would have to compete with this new public option, whatever it looks like. Karen's been at AHIP and one of its predecessors since 1993. realize that.
Do you have to sound so shocked when you say that?
She was very young when she did that. And when she was even younger, she had directed the AFL-CIO's Department of Employee Benefits. She was a professional staff member of what's now the Senate Health Committee. She worked at the Committee for National Health Insurance, which a lot of us had forgotten. And we're very glad to have you here with us today.
Thank you, Ed. Good afternoon, everyone. For those of you who are either current or former Hill staff, and I'm in the latter category, as Ed just said, sitting on this side of the dais is just simply weird. But I'll just not be stopped by that. But I want to thank Ed and the Alliance for the opportunity to participate on this very distinguished panel. I think the Alliance does fantastic work and always adds to the body of information that all of you need on Capitol Hill and those of you who are off the Hill need to wade through these difficult policy questions. I think the central policy question that underlies this discussion is what should be the role of government. And in wrestling with that, what we have tried to do, and I've gotten a great deal of help from my colleagues at AHIP, some of them are here, and I want to thank them for that. We tried to look at this question of role of government through the prism of, if we were in your shoes, what would we like to know? And just as Karen did in her excellent presentation, I'd like to make just some level-setting remarks. 100 years of trying to enact health care reform in this country. So for our community, we hope that this is the year that, after a century, we're actually going to achieve health care reform. And it's with that commitment and that hope that we have worked very hard in our industry to put on the table a series of bold recommendations that would fundamentally change the way the market works today, and I'm going to talk about that. And I think that the reason we need to do it this year is not only for social reform purposes, which history is replete with all sorts of articles about the importance of getting everybody covered, but also for economic reasons, and I suspect we'll talk about a great deal of that. So what are we trying to achieve? We're trying to get everybody in, and we're trying to improve quality, safety, affordability, and effectiveness. And what have we done so far? This is where I'd like to begin. No one in our community is advocating the status quo. I hope you've heard that. I hope you've seen that. And I hope that you've had an opportunity to look at the specific proposals. They're basically in five buckets, from bending the cost curve all the way through, changing the market, covering everyone, and improving quality and value. And with the last bin of improving quality and value, the policy question that all of you are wrestling with is, how do you get to, and how do we as a country best get to this 21st century healthcare system that we want? Is it through the what we have now in the traditional Medicare program? Is it through what we have now in the private sector systems, or is it through a combination? And I'm going to talk a little bit about how we answer that question. I want to also, though, beat the dead horse about fundamentally changing the way the market works in terms of the proposals we've offered, and I'll talk about them very specifically in a moment. But to go back, there's a reason that the market works the way it does. With the exception of Massachusetts, we didn't, as a nation, pass a policy where there was personal responsibility for everyone to be in. So health insurance grew up the way auto insurance and life insurance and other kinds of insurance products. So many of you have queried, why do we have pre-existing conditions? Why do we have health status rating? And because simply, to answer that question, we have a system where if you're not in the employer sector being offered insurance, if you're purchasing on your own, then what happens basically is you have every incentive to stay out of the system until you need it. That pushes up the cost for everyone else. So as we've laid out our recommendations, this issue of personal responsibility is fundamental to addressing those issues that everyone in this room, I believe, wants to be addressed. Now, the next policy question is, what's the architecture that best meets these objectives? And the first point really captures it all. What's the best blend, and where do you put the fulcrum between public and private? And I think that it's very useful, and I suspect we'll talk about this in questions, to talk about the FEHB as a model, Which is not a public sector plan. It's a very aggressive regulation with private sector competition, or look at a number of the European systems which work exactly that way. Okay, so how do we compare design choices? I want to just say a couple of things about this slide. First, what is the best way to get to cost containment? We could do, clearly, a policy choice, as Karen very effectively laid out, is to work on a public program. More and more people would be driven there. I think the Commonwealth Fund has done an excellent report which demonstrates that. I think that there would be very little left of a private market if that were the case, because of the amount of cost shifting now in the system. And if you doubt the amount of cost shifting, just take a look, for any of you who are interested in the policy issues, you don't have to look at any of the speculative studies. Go on the OSHPOD data site, which is the state of California, has the best data system in the country, and you can actually look by category of payer what the payers are paying. And so Medicare is paying on average of 80%. Private sector is paying anywhere from 130 to 150%. If we drive to Medicare payment system, or whatever you think about efficiency of what's going on inside now hospitals, you have to, I think, recognize that that would be a tremendous shock to the system that we have now. We've actually gone beyond now and looked at what would happen if most of the hospitals in California, again, that's the best place to get data, if do nothing in healthcare reform, we should have a data system like California in every state so we can see what's going on. It would be a complete shock to the hospitals, and the major flagship hospitals would be losing a very significant amount of money, and there's a great deal of doubt about whether they survive. That's an issue I think we need to talk about. Also, if we are able to make the market changes that through healthcare reform that we have proposed, the question is, do we need a public program, and is the presence of a public program going to make it difficult to actually have that level playing field for competition? In terms of the keeping the plan you like, I think it's going to be very hard to sustain employer coverage. I think that goes on to the federal budget and somehow begins to get accounted for in the budget. And the administrative savings I'm going to talk about in a moment. What I'd like to say about this slide is, in the interest of time, just a couple of things. I talked about the provider effect, which I think is something worth considering. And is there another course? I believe there is, and I'll talk about that in a moment. But in terms of the federal budget, if we were to have a public program that worked on Medicare rates, and if the benefit package were significantly above what most employers are providing, there are two things that would have to happen there. There would have to be a very aggressive maintenance of effort provision on private employers, which I think in this economy is going to be very difficult. And two, there would have to be a significant increase in the amount of subsidies to employers that are now providing benefits. So we have to walk through that as well. In terms of individuals and families, I think that there is a way to provide more competition than less with respect to health care reform and having a portal that exists in each state through which individuals can find out all the coverage options that are available to them. That does not exist today. The only place it does is Massachusetts, and it's working very well. They have paved the way for a very effective, competitive level playing field. The next slide is, and you can read it in your package, it's the things that are going on in the private sector, where we are in the public sector, how do we get from A to B, could we do better in column one? Yes. But it's very, very difficult to get through the politics of doing the kinds of things that we are doing now in the private sector in terms of disease management, care coordination, dealing with readmission rates and things that are very important to folks. And we provided some data. These are looking at discharges, apples to apples, ARC data looking at California. We're going to be looking at other states that shows the efficiency of the private sector there in terms of particularly what we're doing on disease management, reduction in days and readmissions. This is a comparison of more specific kinds of achievements. I'll say more about that. These are still unpublished data, but Jeff Lemieux, the chair of our policy center, was comfortable enough with our using this, and he's hoping to publish these data very soon. These are new data with respect to the effectiveness of private sector strategies. Finally, administrative costs. If we look at apples to apples, if the government were to take on the kinds of strategies that we are now implementing, and if we had to do an apples to apples comparison, all of these issues would be included in administrative costs. What now we've seen are very thoughtful pieces that zero in on only one part of the administrative load, which is the paying of claims. On the pure paying of claims, our payment of claims percent is equivalent to Medicare. We do all these other things. And so that would be a policy issue that I know we'll talk about in questions. Finally, to end, cost containment. It's the most important thing that the nation needs to take on. President Obama is right. That the nation is being choked by health care costs. We think there's a better way than moving to a public system that or program that moves a massive amount of people in and actually pays Medicare rates. We think it could be better for the system, better for providers, better for consumers, and I'm looking forward to questions to talk more about that. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Karen. Now we turn to John Holohan. He's the director of the Health Policy Research Center at the Urban Institute. He's developed lots of proposals over the years for broad health system reform, most recently in Massachusetts as an example. And he co-authored a very thoughtful paper on the public plan option that's in your packets. Pleased to say that John is not a first-time panelist either for our seminars, and we're glad to have you back, John.
A public plan, a necessary part of health reform, and I think the answer is yes, but I don't think it's a part of a secret or not-so-secret plot to destroy the insurance industry and bring about a single-payer system, so I apologize to anybody that was hoping that that's what this was all about. I think the argument is that that we really do need to reduce the rate of growth in healthcare spending, and a lot of those problems, I think, are caused by the increased concentration in insurance and hospital markets that we've seen in recent years. Obviously, cost containment is necessary to make health reform affordable, particularly in making low-income subsidies affordable. And if you look at the two huge volumes that CBO put together recently, it's pretty hard to be optimistic about most of the other alternative strategies for containing costs. So to me, it's hard to see the alternative to a strong public buyer. Public plan would also help assure access for those with serious health issues, but that's not the focus of what I want to talk about today. Let me say something about the evidence on market concentration. There's a growing literature here. In insurance markets, three or fewer insurers account for 65% of the commercial market in 2003, 34 states are considered highly concentrated by the standards of the FTC or the Department of Justice. Hospital markets, 88%. I recently saw a number 93% of large metropolitan areas are highly concentrated from a 2006 study. And then there's a bunch of studies that show the concentration has contributed to higher hospital costs and increased profitability. And that those rates are higher the more concentrated these markets are, and it goes up from anywhere from 5% to 40% above. And the dynamic here is that that competition is really just not working in a large number of markets. And markets are different all over the country for hospitals and for specialists. So there's no one argument that one could make that would apply everywhere, but we all know that effective competition requires many competitors on both sides of the market, and that just simply is fading away. From one, when there's little concentration among insurers, but there's a dominant hospital system, there's little ability for those insurers to negotiate. When there's a dominant insurer, they do better with discounts, but they really still don't have much leverage over the dominant systems, and an awful lot of those systems are led by teaching hospitals. And in some markets, dominant insurers have no real incentive to be tough negotiators because they themselves don't have tough, real competitors. And the smaller insurers are content to shadow price and to go after good risk. And again, and then the final thing is there's no real competition in many hospital markets because the smaller hospitals simply can't compete with the dominant hospital systems. Insurers are even limited here because if they really go after and really use the market power that they do have with respect to the smaller insurers, they'd end up putting all of the competitors of the dominant systems out of business. So we're really in a bind here that without effective competition and strong demand-side power, we just have growing health care costs, a medical arms race, and growth in costs at GDP plus 2% that we all know we can't sustain. So I think the problem is that there's a lack of countervailing power. And maybe there's other ways to get there, but I think one for sure is a public plan. Let me say what I think this looks like, and I'll go fast because I think this has been said already by Karen Davis, that I see it as a national plan that would compete in local or regional exchanges, that it would have the same insurance market rules would be faced by private plans, same required benefits. Government subsidies would be tied to a mix of the lowest cost plans in the market, not necessarily the public plan. You'd kind of use the Medicare administrative structure, the public rulemaking, Medicare's advances in payment systems, but it would be different benefits and clearly a different risk pool. You'd have MedPAC oversight, which I think is essential to this. And effectively, and hopefully you'd have more effective care management than we've seen. On the administrative cost issue, I think I agree with Karen Ignani that this is often overstated. I think there are differences, but not as much. They're not going to be huge. Some of the studies have not adjusted to the fact, for example, that Medicare has larger claims, and oftentimes all of the government costs don't show up in these studies. But those that have controlled for them, one in particular done by CBO, finds differences of 6 to 11% in administrative costs. But that's not the end of it. The public plan, unlike Medicare, would have a lot more roles to play in it within an exchange. Private plans would probably have fewer. I mean, if you had true insurance market reform, there'd be no need for underwriting, which is expensive for private plans. So I think that these gaps would close, but I think they would still be there. Would the plan use Medicare provider payment rates? I don't think they would. I mean, I think it would be way too disruptive to drop rates for doctors and hospitals by 30% overall. It just wouldn't happen. No responsible body would let that happen. But they can drop a lot and still have a major impact on healthcare costs that we see today. Let me say something about the arguments against the public plan. One is that the public plan is always favored. I mean, I think you look at Medicare Advantage plans and where they are in terms of rates on a risk-adjusted basis, and it's kind of hard to say that they're, you know, that it's guaranteed that the public plan would be favored. It's argued that the private plans have to maintain reserves, have to pay taxes. I think it should be built into the public plan rates, the money that would be required to build up a comparable level of reserves. Clearly, FEHBP plan, to my knowledge, did not pay taxes. I think that could be arranged. I think the issues that would probably remain when you worry about a level playing field are ones that probably go against the public plan. They probably are going to get the higher risk. It's going to be hard to adjust for that in rates. They're probably going to have to be in every market, whereas private competitors would not have to be. So that's some comments there. On the misuse of monopsony power, I think that is a real big concern. If the system does not pay well enough, it could lead to access and quality problems, and that's a big issue. But I think there are constraints on that. First, MedPAC now monitors the effects of Medicare policies on hospitals and physicians, on access to care, on quality, access to capital markets, and so forth. Second, providers can, do, and will lobby the Congress if rates are unfairly reduced. And third, if you have a competing set of private plans and public plans, people can go to private plans if they don't have the access that they want. So that there's a real constraint on the overuse of government power. A point about the cost-shifting issue. The idea here is the public plans will lower rates. That will force private plans to have to raise them. There is another alternative, and that is that hospitals will simply have to reduce their costs. MedPAC had a really interesting analysis of this recently where what they showed was that where insurers have a lot of market power relative to hospitals, there's more financial pressure put on those hospitals, and hospital costs are lower. When hospitals don't have strong market power, or the hospitals have strong market power relative to the insurers, the opposite happens. Private payments are higher, hospital costs go up. And I think the lesson here is that cost shifting occurs when there are weak payers and strong providers. And that, I think, is, you know, if the market shifts towards a strong public buyer and fewer private insurers that are that have more market power because there are fewer of them, then whether hospitals can then at that point shift costs or lower costs to where, you know, we get healthcare costs under some control, I think is enhanced. So let me argue the last thing, and that is that private insurance plans are not going to go away. They will survive. First, the public plan won't use all of the potential market power that it has for reasons that I've already argued. It's MedPAC advising Congress and studying the impact of public rates on the system, provider lobbying, the impact, the ability to leave the public plan if you're an enrollee. Second, private plans are probably more effective, as Karen Ignani has said, in managing utilization. They have really led in disease management programs, and she put up a lot of data that showed that they really do well. I don't know that study well, but and it's California. It could be a Kaiser effect. I don't know how they adjusted for risk, but the findings are stunning. So it's hard to imagine that private plans couldn't compete given that management ability. So I think the private plans are likely to provide maybe better service, or if they do, let's put it that way, if they provide better service and better access at a somewhat higher cost, I think a lot of people are going to want to be in them. They will not go away. And then a lot of this debate assumes that they don't respond and that these private insurers don't become more aggressive in the way they negotiate with providers and in the way they manage care. I think there will be an insurer response. So this 30% differential between private and public is just not going to be there. It's not going to be that big of a difference. And to have access to private plans that offer more, I think, will be, in the end, attractive to people. So to wrap it up in a few seconds here, that I think number one, the public plan, the reasons that I've said, is not going to end the private insurance market. It will stay strong. It will be more effective than it is today. It won't get by cherry-picking risks. It will do better at managing care and way it pays providers. The competition for private plans is important in the way it'll affect public plans that will avoid or limit the excess use of market power by the public plan, because people simply will go elsewhere if they want to. And finally, the public plan is not a panacea. It is not all that we need to do. We need to worry about primary care doctors, medical homes, managing high-cost patients, and so on. But I think if we're serious about cost containment, this has to be part of the deal. And I'll end there.
Great. Thank you, John. We'll pass the clicker from far right to far left. I love that. From our point of view. Our final speaker is Stuart Butler, who's the Vice President of Domestic and Economic Policy Studies at the Heritage Foundation, where he's been since 1979. How about that? He's thought and written about the idea of a public plan, as you can see from the materials in your kits, and manages to speak English and economics on that topic at the same time. It's just amazing. Stuart, thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much. And indeed, I've been working on this issue of healthcare for, indeed, 30 years since the Carter administration. And I must say that I think this time around, compared with a lot of previous periods, particularly during the Clinton administration, this has been a remarkably positive and collegial process of actually trying to figure out how to do this with a strong commitment of people across the spectrum. But I think it's fair to say that sort of two, what I call nuclear minefields, have been encountered in recent weeks. One is the whole idea of a very strong federal health board that would determine in some way precisely what services would be provided. Fortunately, that has been avoided for now, at least been reduced in its importance. But the second is this idea of a government-sponsored plan competing with the private plans in a government-sponsored competition. And in my view, if that's part of the final package that goes to the Hill, then I believe that over time, that government-sponsored plan will be the coverage. And if this persists in trying to argue this and put forward this public plan as a central part of the final legislation, I really do believe it will break up the coalition that would otherwise achieve real change in this country. And it's not just me. If you actually look at the Washington Post this morning in its editorial, let me just quote from it. It said, "The fixation on a public plan is bizarre and counterproductive. It would be a huge mistake for the left to torpedo reform over this question, and I strongly agree with that. Let me just point out the basic problem that the public plan is supposed to fix. And it's really sort of three issues in a way. One is that only by having a public plan, many people argue, can you deal with the problem of high cost or low income populations that have particular needs. But of course we've been spending a lot of the time, a lot of effort in joint discussions and so on to deal with precisely that issue. And we made a lot of progress in terms of looking at risk adjustments, reinsurance, guaranteed issue, and so on as ways of dealing with that. The second argument is essentially that you've got to build up public confidence in some way to have competition, and that people will be afraid of a system of competitive plans unless there's a public plan there. And I'll talk about that in a moment a little bit more. And then the idea that we've got to widen choice and that a public plan is kind of crucial to this public choice, to the choice in the system, because only a sort of lean, efficient government plan can sort of force and shake up these flabby AHIP members that Karen Ignani represents, and that's what's really needed to sort of goose up the system, as I put it. Well, let's look at the different versions of this. I think there are two broad versions. The first is what you might call the aggressive Medicare-like competitor, that by the use of lower payment rates, by really aggressively getting costs under control, that this will really force other competitors to pay likewise. Now, you've heard the arguments against that in terms of the effect of cost shifting and what this really means. There's also the argument that there are inherent lower administrative costs in a public plan, and that this is an inherent advantage that clearly is necessary as a choice. John Holohan discussed that. I won't spend much time talking about this right now, but I must say that it seems to me that anybody can get overhead costs down if you run a plan and you don't actually have to advertise it, as is the case in Medicare, because you already have the market. You don't do a whole lot about fraud, which Medicare doesn't really do. You don't have to build up networks of cost-effective doctors, and you don't have to worry about reserves or a $36 trillion unfunded obligation. If you don't have to do any of that, you can actually keep your overhead down pretty well, I think. So let's not be naive that the idea of a public plan of this variety is to build up, to over time become the larger and larger offering and to essentially dominate the market. And if you look carefully at what Karen and others write, that's essentially what they foresee. It's what the Lewin Group shows in its analysis and so on. Then there's another version which has just sort of come up more recently by my good friend Len Nichols and John Bertko, what I call the good cop version. And this is really your sort of friendly public plan. Sort of one of the guys, and really just the same as everything else, and really no different from a private plan. It's a little bit like, in my view, sort of bringing a three-week-old tiger cub to your apartment as a pet and just saying, well, look how nice it is. Really, over time, it's not going to be a problem for anybody, so get with the program. In other words, the idea of keeping people comfortable by having something that really is almost identical to a private plan. And under this arrangement, this version of the public plan, there would be no fixed payment rates. It would have the same rules, no special financial arrangements. Technically, only it would be a government plan, really just for show, if you like, or to make people feel better. Let me just look at this in a little bit more. The common theme behind both of these versions is the idea that a public and private plan will compete on a true level playing field. For you to believe that, you've got to believe, I believe, that in my view, that people like Pete Stark and Henry Waxman and others in Congress will do nothing to stack the deck in favor of this public plan. They'll just sit back and let the chips sort of fall as they will, and they will do nothing to advantage the public plan. In my view, if you take that view, if you believe that, you're probably the kind of person who believes professional wrestling is real. And I certainly don't. Because the essential dilemma, really, in all of these approaches to a public plan is that if you have exactly the same rules for both the, if it's operated in identically, in an identical version as the private plans, then why have it? Unless you just assume that government managers are inherently more efficient. But if you have a different rules, then you really can't avoid the deck being stacked in some way. Let me just look a little bit at this argument that you really do need a public plan to make people feel better about dealing with competition. And this is just actually, I've taken this slide literally from the CalPERS site, where it just sort of shows how, in the case of the choices in California for state employees, like pretty well state employees everywhere, there really isn't any mention of the fact that one of these plans is a self-insured plan through the state. In other words, the public plan itself is not used to in any way calm anybody down. It doesn't seem to be necessary for state employees. In the federal employee program, you don't have a public plan. In other words, federal employees don't seem to feel it necessary to have this public plan to feel comfortable about an exchange with competing plans. Uwe Reinhardt, in his piece in the package, points out that in the German system, in the Swiss system, in the Dutch system, in none of these where they have large exchanges do they actually have public plans. So I think there's a couple of lessons for this, that first of all, people don't need a public plan to feel comfortable at competition. And the key is setting the rules, setting the overarching rules of competition for an exchange. That's what's important to focus on. That's what they do in the FEHBP. That's what they do in these foreign examples and so on. That's the critical thing, not having a public plan in the competition itself. And there are some very specific issues associated with this idea of a level playing field. It assumes a wall of separation between the government running the competition and the government running the public plan. And as Len Nichols points out, that would require some very specific things to be put into place for that to happen. I made a mistake, incidentally, on the penultimate one. It should be, must be, no systematic cost shifting. And it really does take, in my view, a staggering leap of faith to assume that the Congress and the United States government will somehow operate like a sort of benign umpire in the system when it actually is also a team owner. And it will allow its team to basically just either win or lose, depending on how the situation turns out. And there are various ways in which the level playing field can be very much altered. Indeed, in Karen's piece on this, in terms of the way the Medicare extra system will operate, if you make that public plan a default option, which she does and which Jacob Hacker does in his proposal, like an auto-enrollment. If you don't decide, you are in the public plan. Well, anybody who's looked at auto-enrollment in the pension system or knows anything about behavioral economics knows that gives a massive advantage to the public plan. We also see that if you give employers an option of simply just dropping people into a public plan, if it's cheaper for them, as the Lewin analysis shows, you can very quickly rack up huge increases in the public plan. So there's various ways of altering, in very subtle ways, the rules to favor the public plan. And that's why I think that it's so critically important to recognize that this is the case. And let me just end by just pointing out that if you look at other ways of trying to achieve the objectives that are purported to be for the public plan, there are many ways to do that, in particular by looking at the FEHBP model in exchange. Mr. Obama said that's really what he wants to focus his proposal on, and that's good. And it's important to recognize some things about it and how it could be a model and how it could be improved. There is no public plan, I repeat again, in the FEHBP. The government does, however, negotiate with certain private plans to provide coverage on a national basis. That could be improved by allowing the government to negotiate on a state basis more refined versions of that national plan. But that's how they achieve the idea of some kind of safe harbor arrangement. You can also look at changing the exchange system, again, to look at ways of doing that on the state level to make it improve. So there are various ways, I think, of achieving the objectives that are stated to be for a public plan without all these dangers that are inherent in the fact you would not get a level playing field. So just to end, I think it is very important that we get back to the collegial process that has been making such progress and do not torpedo that potential progress and success by pushing this idea of a public plan option. Thank you.
Well, I think we have unanimity here on the panel. So there ought to be no problem in settling this the policy dispute. Now you get a chance to enter into the dialogue. There are, as I pointed out, green question cards. You can write a question thereon and hold it up and hand it to whoever is holding up those green cards now, and they'll get them up here. There are microphones up here for those of you in a position to squeeze through those narrow aisles and get to them. There were some questions submitted in advance. Let me just start as those are being collated and you're finding your way to the front with one or two of those. Questioner asks or says, Medicare costs are well below those of private insurance in most parts of the country, but isn't that because of Medicare being so big it can set prices and not negotiate them? And if that's true, won't the addition of the public plan using Medicare rates make government a 1,000-pound gorilla instead of an 800-pound gorilla? The first question is, how do you deal with the question of whether or not the public plan uses Medicare rates? Karen, you assumed that that it did. John, I heard you say something a little different.
Well, just to clarify, I understand there are no 800-pound gorillas, that in fact they only weigh about 300. obviously, one could have a variety of options, both the process and the level for setting the rates. I think the first thing to understand is this is in the context of paying providers for covering the uninsured. It's in the context of bringing Medicaid up to Medicare rates. So those are huge infusions of new revenues to providers. The particular proposal we have, which does pay in the public health insurance plan at public rates, is phased in gradually over time. It starts with small businesses under 100 employees and individuals. And as a result, while there's some shifting from small business private coverage to the public health insurance plan, in fact, provider revenues go up because of this new infusion of money for the uninsured and for bringing up Medicaid rates. It's really only in outright years that provider revenues go up more slowly than they otherwise would have. But over the period from 2010 to 2020, provider revenues go up by 73%. So there is not a 20% reduction in the level of provider payment. Now, obviously, there are various ways one could do that. We assumed in that proposal that the public health insurance plan would pay a new innovative payment method, a bundled payment with the level approximately where Medicare is. One could set it at the midpoint between commercial rates and public plan rates. In that case, provider revenues always are higher than they otherwise would have been under the current system. So it isn't implementing this in a way that leads to financial instability in the industry. As John Hollihan said, you would want a process like the MedPAC process, looking every year at those levels, at the economic situation in the provider community, and making a judgment of what would ensure access to care, financially strong institutions, but not overpayment. The final compromise, of course, is that one could have everybody paying at the same rate. In other words, extend to private payers the payment rate of the public health insurance plan. And again, when you think about it over time, you could do that by slowing the rate of increase in private payer rates so that they would then, over time, narrow the differentials that would exist between private provider payment rates and Medicare.
Karen?
I'm sorry. John, did you want to jump in? Go right ahead, please.
I'll just add, I think What's complicated about this is that I don't think anybody can say where you set those rates. I think you can easily set them below the average of the private sector now. But it would have to be, people have to worry and do this with great care. But I think the ability to save money and to reduce the rate of growth over time would clearly be present. The other thing that is really important is that I really do believe there will be a private insurer response that would bring down what they pay as well. And I think you could get as much savings out of that as you're going to get out of the lower Medicare rates. So I think that's important to keep that in mind.
I just want to say, I wanted to make a comment on Ed's question, but listening, I hope you all have the same reaction. I think the panel has really been, I enjoyed listening to my colleagues' presentations. This is the first time that I've been, with the exception of the session that Karen and I did, Ed, with you up in Baltimore, you'd rarely get an opportunity to have this kind of deep dive into the policy issues. So whatever your model is, you should bottle it. It's very, very important to have this kind of discussion. I think the underlying question that we're wrestling with is how do you deal with bending the cost curve and how do you best deal with the trend issue? And CBO has projected the trend, I guess with the actuary's new numbers, it's 6.2 on average in rate of increase annually, you know, on average over 10 years. So how do you get that down? And we agree with Karen's numbers in the Commonwealth in terms of the impact of taking the slope of that curve down, and you could free up $3 trillion, and then the question is, how do you do it? For us, as we look at the implications on the whole risk management side, the quality improvement, the safety side, I think there are a couple of things that really stand out. How can we pay for episodes of care so that the anesthesiologist isn't billing, the individual actually providing surgery isn't billing separately? All these, we have unbundled care now. So how do we deal with episodes? We're beginning to make some real strides in the private sector there, and I think that offers real promise. How do we improve primary care? Part of it is medical homes, yes. We were doing it 10 years ago. It was called capitation. Nobody likes to use that term, but essentially that's what medical homes are, giving primary care physicians a real incentive. We're doing that now in Medicare Advantage. We're paying more than traditional Medicare, and we're seeing real results. But there are other parts of, I think, improving primary care in terms of nurses and other health practitioners that we're seeing dramatic results. So that would lead you to a scope of practice law discussion, because in some areas, nurses and other practitioners can't actually provide the kinds of services that could be very integral here, particularly in rural areas, in areas that are underserved, where we have particular disparities, et cetera. How do we deal with readmissions? We now have some very, I'm not talking about just what we've put on the screen here, NCQA is capturing these data as well in terms of what we're doing on readmissions, working collaboratively with the hospitals. Those are just a couple of things. So the question is will we bend the cost curve exclusively by dealing with an administered pricing system, or how do we get that balance in terms of taking down unit costs, but at the same time really driving toward those 21st century models that I think we're all struggling for? In the health plan community, we've learned a great deal in the sense that it's no longer clerk to physician looking at these issues, the management of radiology, for example. It's physician to physician using specialty society guidelines. So there's been a lot of advances over the last 10 years, or the last time we actually had this policy issue, which I think it's very important to bring into this conversation of how you best get to this vision that we all have.
Okay. A very quick comment. I think this issue of Medicare payment rates and its impact on the private plans is very important. And as Karen said, I mean, one way you could envision theoretically a level playing field, as she said, is to extend the public payment rates to the private sector. That's precisely the problem, that when you set up this kind of situation, sometimes the only way to achieve the apparent fairness is, in fact, to extend the very rules and the same price controls into the private sector. That's precisely what I believe would eventually happen.
All right, we have a couple of questioners at the microphones, and we'll start here and then go to my right.
John Hollihan said that
You want to identify yourself first.
Yes, Russell Mochiber. John Hollihan said that it's he's not part of a secret plot to destroy the private insurance industry. There's actually a public plot to destroy the private insurance industry. It's called H.R. 676, single payer. And it has 76 members of the House who support it. And I believe the Lewin Group did a side-by-side analysis of all the plans currently floating in Congress, and they found that it saves the most money. It's Medicare for all. And I think the idea is that the private health insurance industry deserves to be destroyed because, like in Canada and the UK, it's unlawful to sell private health insurance for basic health needs. So that's the idea behind single payer. And my question to the panel is, other than the fact that it would give the death penalty to Mizignani's companies, why not do it?
Well, let me leap to the defense of a mixed public-private system. I do think that offering both private plans and a public health insurance plan creates the opportunity for both to bring the strengths that they have to offer. Private plans, as Stuart mentioned, can have flexibility about setting up networks of providers. It's very hard for a public health insurance plan to exclude certain hospitals, exclude certain physicians, even if they are not prudent users of resources. They tend to, because of the political pressures, be included. Karen had a slide of the various kinds of utilization management techniques that private providers, private plans use. Again, very hard for public plans to do that. Public plans have the advantage of lower administrative costs. They have the advantage of economies of scale in purchasing and leverage as a result of that. In this, we're talking about new methods of payment, and I think Karen and I are in agreement on that, of win-win solutions that bundle payment over a certain portion of care. I wouldn't call it capitation, but you might call it partial capitation. It might be a global fee for primary care. In the case of physician practices, might be a global fee for hospital episodes of care that cover all care for 30 days. But the great advantage of that is that you give a reward to providers, whether those are physician practices or hospitals, that if they prevent hospital readmissions, they will share in those savings. If it's a physician practice acting as a medical home, that if they control those chronic conditions and prevent hospital admissions, they can share in those savings. So I think to really have competition, a value-added competition about innovation in payment, innovation in working with providers to have win-win for patients yields the best possible result. I think when you don't have a choice, people get lazy and don't look for new ways of competing and adding value. And I think, in fact, one of the problems with the private insurance industry today is because it is so concentrated that you don't have those kinds of incentives. So I think the challenge of having a public plan will bring out the best in the private insurance industry. Having the choice, if you're dissatisfied with what's available from a public health insurance plan, of going to a private plan, in fact, puts a check on any of those extremes.
Stuart and then Karen.
Yes. Well, I've lived 30 years in the United States, but I've also lived 30 years under a public plan in the UK under the National Health Service. The fact I'm here may be some comment on this rather than in the UK. But the point is that there is an honest argument for a single-payer system. If you know what you're getting, if you understand what's involved, if you understand the issues associated with it and are prepared to make those choices, it may well be the right option. It may well be that another option is the right approach. But the fact is that we're not having a debate here about one or the other. If we were, that would be fine. The issue is, if you set up this mixed system of a public and private system together, competing with the government making the rules, is it a stable outcome, or will it inevitably go down one direction? And that's the issue. I don't believe that you can, in fact, set up a stable outcome of a sort of a public plan just being sort of there and not being favored by some or discriminated against in some other administrations, possibly. I just don't believe it's a stable outcome. And therefore, I think we really ought to discuss whether we want a public system or a single-payer system. Again, let me just quote from the Post editorial today, which talks about what happens when you start altering rules, favoring, and so on. As it says, such power, in other words, the power to make these kinds of changes in rules, if exercised in a public plan option, eventually would produce a single-payer system, which is why so many people support it. If that's where the country wants to go, it should do it explicitly, not by default. I could not agree more. The problem with what we have in this proposal is that it would get us to that position without actually honestly discussing it and saying, do we want to go in that direction? That's what my problem is with it.
Karen?
I was going to go exactly where Stuart did, with a bit of a detour. First, a number of our plans have been invited to Britain and to Canada to provide disease management and care coordination, which the government plans there respectively have had difficulty constructing. And it's very exciting what we're seeing. I also think what's very exciting is the fact that you can have national health systems that operate with very aggressive, essentially the analog in our country would be federal regulation, that prescribe the rules that Stuart is talking about, that make everything very transparent, lay out the rules of the game so there's no inherent advantage of living in state A versus state B. And that is going to be a challenge here in drafting legislation, but we need to have this regulatory uniformity. It can be executed at the state level, but unless we have that regulatory uniformity, I think that people, our citizens, won't feel that the systems are inherently fair. I think Karen did a very thoughtfully talked about the other side of the issues in terms of the progress that's being made. So the question is, where do we put the fulcrum between public and private? What is the role of government? And I think, unfortunately, the question of public plan, yes or no, the bimodal kind of question, has really taken a little bit of the attention away from this question of how do we set up the rules, where should it be done, what are the intergovernmental relationship questions, which all of you who work on the Hill will struggle mightily with. And I think it's important for maybe the Alliance would have a session on that. I think that's very important in terms of making sure that we get this right. But I'm encouraged in looking at other countries and the FEHBP that there are models. But without a doubt, the regulatory system at present here is not adequate. And we need to change it. We need to make it more robust. And that's precisely what we've proposed.
John?
Just a couple of quick comments. The savings numbers that the person who asked the question brought out are just not realistic. And I've seen other people who do this kind of modeling make these assumptions about what the kinds of savings you could get from Medicare rates. It would be such a dramatic impact on the hospital and physician system that it would never occur to that degree. So often the savings and the advantage of single payers are so overstated that I would caution you to think about that some more. I think with regard to what Stuart is saying, I don't think you can predict the outcome of the way this is going to go and how many people will really be in the public plan versus private, and that it's inevitable that it's all going to be public. I just don't see that. I think there's too many advantages of having private plans. But Stuart could be right. So I'll just stop that. But I don't see how anybody can predict that.
Yes, go ahead, Peter.
Hi, I'm Peter McManaman, a health economist from Silver Spring, and I've been in D.C. for almost 37 years working on health care, so at the bite level in some cases. And I'm not personally opposed to a public plan, but I just don't know how you get there from here. And I think the debate right now may be a little premature because they're talking about things that really need to be better articulated, particularly how do you staff it, how do you price it, and who would buy it. The administrative costs, I agree with many of the commentators. Medicare pays big bills. 20% of the bennies are hospitalized in any one year, less than 10% on the private side. Medicare enrollment typically is one time only, disenrollment one time only. All the plans are individual plans. For the most part, there are no births. They don't have to worry about out-of-state benefits. They cover the country. There are administrative savings, but they're not going to be as big as many people expect. On the physician side, how do you staff it? The Times, just a couple weeks ago, had an article about people worrying about doctors participating in Medicare. My research done from HCFA data and private data was that there are an awful lot of doctors who have a minimal attachment to the program. They may do a couple of $1,000s in business, have a handful of patients, either because of their specialty or the patients have aged in. And if they're having trouble right now, they could walk away, unless, particularly if they're given the opportunity of taking a 25% across-the-board cut in their private patients who would shift to a public plan for the same services at lower rates. As John said, I don't think it's going to happen. The actual premiums might be a little lower, but you're still going to have a family policy about $9,000. Now, if we look at COBRA, where people pay 100% plus 2%, only 20%, 27% of the people eligible actually enroll in that. So unless there was an additional subsidy program on top of this public plan, it's not going to help the uninsured.
Peter, I know there's a question in there somewhere.
Well, I'm getting to it.
That was
good. The major one, I guess, is that right now, according to Kaiser, 85% of the employers who offer employee-based insurance offer one and only one plan. So how are you going to deliver it in a setting where there isn't a choice right now? And if the only way to do it is in a public forum, won't you have to cash out the benefits, and then all of the presumed savings are going to be taken up in payroll and income taxes?
Okay.
That's my question. How do you get there without resolving those issues beforehand?
Karen, you want to take a crack at that?
Well, obviously, one does have to build some administrative structures, the most important one being a national health insurance exchange. So come back next week for that. But we have seen in Massachusetts that it is possible to set up a choice among plans, and it does give people more opportunities than at least half of the working population that now only has a single plan offered to them. But I think we have to do it in a way that is economical. We just, given our current economic situation, cannot tolerate waste anywhere in our system. We really have to put a premium on value added. So to look at the administrative overhead that's now 14 to 17% and say we can't live with that, we have to get down to under 10%. In other countries that Stuart touted in Switzerland and the Netherlands, administrative overhead is 5%. We simply should not accept. If we could do as well as the best countries on administrative costs, we could save $100 billion a year. And that would be enough to provide the kinds of income-related premium assistance that is going to be required to make a $9,000 premium affordable to a family that only makes $20,000, $30,000 a year. So, an overall framework, choices for everyone, shared financial responsibility, employers contributing to health insurance premiums, premium income-related premium assistance, but vying a high-value product, one that has little waste, that has little going for overhead, that has innovative payment methods that rewards hospitals and physicians for working with patients to manage those conditions. That's the win-win over time.
I just wanted to say a little bit about administrative costs. I think that there are, you made me think about a number of issues that I didn't talk about in the presentation. And so thank you for that. And just a couple of things quickly. One is that with respect to the overall level of administrative costs, CMS does a very good job in the National Health Expenditure Estimates of tracking this very, very carefully and it's on average for the last 25 to 30 years, 12 to 13% overall. In the area of the individual market and the small market, it's higher because the sales and administrative expenses are higher because you're actually going out trying to find individuals. Brokers play a very, very important role, not just selling the product. If you talk to the broker community, particularly, one of their most important features is explaining what various features work for an individual family, the kitchen table test. As we think about health reform, to the extent that we're going to move to a system where each state would have a portal, and we shouldn't have them reinventing this in every state, we should have at the federal level a template that gets presented to states so that they don't have to spend money and a great deal of time doing it, whatever we think is the best way to do it. And Massachusetts, I think, has done a great deal of work that should be modeled, and I know they have some thoughts about how to even improve that very good system. But that would allow people what they don't have, particularly in the individual and small group market right now. They don't have benefit managers working on their behalf. They would have more information in real time about what's being offered. That's precisely what's going on in Massachusetts. We think brokers would still play a very important role in this kitchen table test, but we think costs could come down. We also think, and we've been working with and listening very closely to the provider communities, both doctors as well as hospitals, there are things that we can all do, starting with our community, to simplify the administrative processes. And we're working very diligently. You'll be hearing more from on that. But in the European systems, they don't have this very complicated regulatory system, and I was thinking about bringing this slide, and I didn't because I didn't give it to our colleagues beforehand, but as I was prepping this weekend, we have a slide which shows exactly how we're regulated, and I'll give it to Ed, and it looks at how each individual product is regulated and how all of the different products are regulated. Suffice to say, there is no white space on this chart. We are doing things both at the federal government and the state time and time. It's just there are multiple functions being carried out in multiple places. That's just to encapsulate the problem. So as we go to health reform, we think, yes, there's things that we can definitely do, but I was struck by the point, the thoughtful one that Karen made. It's an opportunity not only to challenge our community and others to do better on the issue of administrative simplification, it's also an opportunity to really look at, are we getting value from the current regulatory structure? And I could make an argument that it has now become so complex we're not. It's not transparent to anyone. And we'll have a number of recommendations, but if you want to bring the cost down, those are very, very important issues to look at as well.
Thank you. A couple of points before we go on. One is I commend the two gentlemen standing at the microphones because they are certain that their questions are going to get asked. I am not certain that those of you who filled out green cards are going to get your question asked. So depending on the degree of urgency with which you wrote that card, you may want to try to shuffle up an aisle and get to a microphone. And secondly, before you shuffle and afterwards, I would urge you to pull out the blue evaluation form and offer us some feedback on how we can make these programs better for you. Yes, go ahead. The gentleman in the suspenders.
Yes, thank you, Ed. The Gary Christofferson wrote at both a national single-payer approach plan in 1986 and a mixed public-private sector plan in 86. The idea being both approaches can work, we just have to make some decisions, going back to a number of the commentaries. Second part is I was a senior scholar for a while at IOM and decided to sit down and figure out how many different approaches could actually accomplish everybody covered and having access, cost being constrained, quality being improved. And after I got to about 17 or 18 different approaches that all would do that, I decided that was probably as many as I needed to do. So I've been at this for a few years, as a number of my colleagues here have as well. My concern here in the discussion is we're now getting very late in the game, not just in terms of decades, but in terms of June, July, August, September, and October. And while I think it is true, we are far beyond and far better than we were in 1994, I see in this discussion here some discomfort I see some sort of sense of, rather than trying to find that fulcrum point that's appropriate, sort of looking at the worst-case scenarios and, to some extent, the best-case scenarios, both of which are likely to be incorrect, by the way. The issue of whether we can design an approach that really is a good mixed model is really just a testament about how smart we are. And let me take one particular case in point, which is you've sort of touched on in a couple of different cases I want to come back to. The question is, can we create what I would call a fair payment system, which I fooled around with back in the 80s on, which essentially is a single payment system for everybody, uses the best experience we've had from private sector, public sector, payment levels are the same, essentially, et cetera, and so forth. It's done collaboratively between the public and private sectors, and there is a political balance that's built into that, which I know Stuart is worried about, and rightfully so. So can we go to a fair payment system that really everybody plays by the same rules, and can that be one of the building blocks toward good health reform?
Go ahead, Stuart.
I mean, I think that the idea that you can set a, quote, fair payment system, which is something which has eluded us for thousands of years, that we can sort of do that within the next few weeks, and everybody will be happy with it, I just think it's just a non-starter. I mean, the idea of using essentially a price control system, which is what you're talking about, to set prices and to use that throughout the system, to conduct one-sixth of the U.S. economy, I think the results will be disastrous. It's as simple as that. And you know, that's your threshold sort of consideration. I do think that, as numbers have said, that this isn't the question of saying you don't have government involved in any way in the process. It's the issue of what is the appropriate role. And I think Karen, myself, and maybe others too, sort of feel that the right approach, and actually if you ask ordinary Americans about the role of government in healthcare, they say we want somebody to have fairness in the system, to make sure it operates fairly, and that everybody plays by the rules. You've heard this over and over again on this panel. So the idea of saying let's have the government play that role through an exchange of some form, I think there's agreement on. I think there's agreement across the spectrum, really, among people who've been working on this about dealing with various pieces of the architecture. The problem is what we're seeing today, that once you bring in the idea of a public plan that is administered and beholden in some way to a government also setting the rules, that is inherently unstable, politically unstable. It will not remain like that. Something will change over time. And that's the problem that we have to deal with. So I think there's a problem with price controls. That's why I don't agree with Karen about migrating these Medicare rules and Medicare pricing in the rest of the system. That's a simple price control issue, and price controls have failed for centuries. And then the second is the idea of where is the government's role, and you limit it to the setting of the rules. If you get that right, as we see in the FEHBP, as we've seen in most of the European countries, and so on, then you can have something that people can all agree on. And that's what we need to be focused on, how we can agree on the end result.
Karen?
Well, I think there's a lot to commend a mixed public-private system and encouraging each to do what they do best. First of all, on administering claims, I think everyone agrees that it makes sense to contract with private insurers to do that. Stuart said there's no public plan in Phoebe. Said it over and over, no public plan in Phoebe. But truthfully, the federal government does contract with a private insurer, pays them an administrative services fee, but self-insures for that coverage, and the government holds the reserves, and that is the Blue Cross Blue Shield standard option. You could call that a public plan. It is not underwritten. It's not profits. It is paying the claims. They are paid an administrative services fee. But they also use their own provider payment rates, so that's a separate issue. I think the second thing on which we agree is the need to move to innovative payment methods. If we're just talking about fee-for-service, we're not going to succeed, whether that's private plans or public plans. I think the third thing that we agree on is the importance of expanding and letting thrive the private integrated delivery systems and regional plans that Karen in her slide show in California, which is dominated, I would assume, by Kaiser Permanente, but in other areas by regional plans, that when you have a health system, when you own a hospital, when you have physicians who work in that, when you have systems of care, electronic health records, quality improvement units, innovation units, you can achieve those kinds of things. So those competing on that basis, I think we could all agree on. In fact, if we look at the Medicare experience with bids, and you're talking about HMOs that have these kinds of systems, their bid is 98% of Medicare fee-for-service costs. Those kinds of private plans can compete. But the final point has to do with Stu's harping on administered prices. The truth of the matter is the private fee-for-service plans and the dominant commercial insurers that do not represent healthcare delivery system use Medicare's payment system to pay physicians. They may pay at a higher level, but they've used the resource-based relative value schedule in Medicare. So if Medicare leads, develops new innovative payment methods, it is likely that private plans will follow that. The only question is whether we have a sensible process for getting a reasonable rate, not the method.
Karen, let me just follow up, if you'll bear with me just a second. I've heard, having been privileged to sit in on a few meetings of the Commission on a High-Performance Health System, some of the members talk about the need of a public plan option as a way of extending whatever payment reforms that Medicare puts in place. And they point to the RBRBS, they point to the DRG system. Is that a big deal? Is that a big part of the savings that you show on your slides?
Absolutely. Again, Karen and I agree that we ought to slow the rate of increase from roughly 6.5% to 5.5%. We ought to get 1 percentage point savings over time, and that's what gets you the $3 trillion over time. It's just that we've laid out a plan for getting there. Karen has a chart, but not a plan, a goal, but not a plan. And one of the big advantages of having a public health insurance plan offered through a national health insurance exchange, it would be to charge that plan with using these types of innovative methods that can slow the rate of increase over time because they're achieving savings from reduced complications, better control of chronic conditions, shorter lengths of stay, fewer readmissions, and sharing those savings between the payer and the provider. It's that type of mechanism that a public health insurance plan would introduce into the system.
And I've got to give Karen Ignani the chance to reveal her plan right now.
Yes, I would never have the temerity to come up in front of this important group and have a chart without a plan. But you're right, I didn't get a chance to talk about it because I ran out of time. It's the Italian in me. I'm sorry, I ended up talking too much about previous slides. I'll do it very, very quickly. The plan is the following, and it's radical. So let me say that out at the outset. The idea is we've tried this, and Gary made a very good point. We've tried this a number of different ways in our country, and it's hard to get through the politics of actually doing cost containment. So our radical idea is that we challenge the different stakeholders to come forward and identify savings in their areas that could be scorable, would be effective. No one knows more about their relative area than they do from the standpoint of a particular stakeholder. We've actually been talking a lot to different communities, and it's very exciting. But this is different than government saying, you will do this, you will do that. It's not squishy, however, because we have to hit the target that Karen's talking about. She's absolutely right. And it's built on this idea of how do we change the payment system radically to go back to some of the ideas in a kinder, gentler way that were discarded maybe 10 to 15 years ago, but really work. It's about managing care. And there's a reason that California has some of the lowest rates of increase in health care costs, because it's about the only state that really manages care. You have physicians organized in physicians' groups. They're called IPAs, and they work very, very effectively. They work to guidelines. They work to standards. So we've learned a lot from the old things, what didn't work. We've learned a lot from listening to our colleagues in the different specialty societies, in the hospital community, the pharmaceutical community. So we don't have the temerity anymore to say, you should do this, you should do this. But this idea of shared responsibility is what we've been talking about, and to bake that into health care reform. And so I appreciate the opportunity. I can say much more. I know this is not that, this is not the topic of that issue, but we have many more thoughts and very specific ideas and proposals along that line of thinking.
Good. Thank you. Yes, you've been very patient.
Thanks. Chris Jacobs with the House Republican Conference. Hearing all this discussion of secret plots and crowd out and everything else like that, there's a quote that I think would be relevant to the debate. Quote, "We are not taking a free enterprise system and federalizing it. We are, in fact, improving the entrepreneurial and competitive possibilities by going toward a public option, because plans are going to have to compete for the business. They are going to have to compete on the basis of price and on the basis of quality, and the beneficiary will be the taxpayer." Now, I don't know if that's an accurate characterization of what the advocates of a public option see as the benefits of it, but I can tell you that this is a quote from the Clinton administration in 1993 talking about the federal government-run direct student lending program, which the Obama administration is now proposing to federalize in its entirety. We supposedly set up a level playing field, and private lenders ended up getting about 80% of the business on a level playing field. And all of a sudden, Barack Obama and Ted Kennedy, as part of the budget proposal, said, we need to eliminate these wasteful overpayments. We need to federalize and have the government running the entire student lending industry. So my question is, how does this build trust that people, the politicians in charge of running a government plan, would not sooner or later wake up 3, 5, 10 years down the line and say, oh, this isn't the level playing field we established, and we need to do something to shift the playing field in favor of the government plan or eliminate private insurance entirely?
Good question. Karen Ignani.
I wanted to start because I think that it is, as we look at the different issues of whether it's student lending, financial services, healthcare, what have you, generally what you see is one of the number one problems is that the private sector entities that are in the middle of those industries don't generally come forth with a diagnosis that there's a problem that needs to be solved and there's leadership that needs to be taken on behalf of those private entities. In our case, for healthcare, I can only speak about healthcare because that's really what I know. But in healthcare, I can tell you that our board had a great deal of discussion about what role were we going to play, what role were we expected to play in 2009. This began about 2.5 to 3 years ago. And they uniformly said, it's our responsibility to earn a seat at the table, to demonstrate our value, to be very clear about what's working, what's not working, and how we could recommend doing the deep dive for entities that are in the middle of the healthcare system, doing a deep dive to say, here's the way we should move from A to B to solve the public's program. So I'm glad you asked the question, because that's what led us to a proposal about guarantee issue, ending health status rating, not writing out people or making it difficult for them with pre-existing conditions. But you need to keep in mind, there was never a social policy that everybody should be in this country, and that's why the market grew up the way it did, which is why we've spent so much time actually looking at what we can offer by way of a solution, so people don't feel that they have to drop back to a public strategy to get the kind of reform that people want. So I'm glad you asked the question about sort of how you get from here to there, because it's important that everybody here understand that we represent a group of people who are integrally involved in the healthcare system, and want to participate with you in trying to solve it. And I don't think necessarily the private sector, people here on this side of on the Hill, all of you, are not necessarily used to hearing that from the private sector. It's important that you do, because there are no entities that know better than we about what kinds of things are working and not working. So I appreciate your asking the question.
Karen?
Well, I'm not going to get into student lending, but this mixed public-private system has a lot of checks and balances built in, and I would say the most important one that we haven't talked about is the role of employers. Again, under our estimates, the number of people covered under employer plans would, in fact, grow from 164 million today to 196 million. Those employers have the choice of buying privately if they're not getting good quality, good value out of the plans through an insurance exchange. So it's not a government system. It is a mixed public-private system with a very strong built-in checks and balances that come from offering people choices, but also a strong role for employers in deciding whether to take their group into such an exchange or to buy directly.
John?
Yeah, just a real quick comment. I think this goes back to the whole thing again about trying to predict the future. I mean, it's sort of like saying, you know, let's do X, and X may look good, but it's really going to yield, you know, lead to Y, and you're going to really hate Y, so let's not do X. And it's just, how do you know? I mean, I could lay out an hypothesis that if you stay with just private plans in this world of concentrated, you know, the market concentration, particularly among hospitals and specialists, that private plans can't control, that 10 years from now, there will be no disagreement. We will have a single-payer system. I honestly really do believe that. I think if you don't have a mixed plan, the next thing is single-payer. And 80% of the population will want it because they can't afford what we have. So I think we can all play that game of what's the future going to look like if we do this. But you got to, you know, we can all do it. So,
yes, yeah, right ahead.
Hi, my name is Beth Hadley, and I wanted to follow up exactly on that question raised by Mr. Hallahan about market concentration, and I'd like to hear Mr. Butler respond to that reason for a public plan, and then I'd love to hear Mr. Hallahan respond. Mr. Butler, thank you.
Well, let me just say, I was going to comment at the end of what John said, that yes, of course, nobody can predict the future with certainty. What you have to do is to look at probabilities. What you have to do is to look at past performance, and talking about the student loan system is a good example of that, saying what's happened in the past when we've tried to do these sorts of things. You've got to look at what the stated intent is of the various key players, particularly in the Congress, who are arguing for this, and the people who support it, and what their stated objective is. I think you've got to look at all those kinds of things. So it's not just a question, it's not true to say you can't have any knowledge whatsoever of what's likely to happen in the future. You can make some reasonable projections, and that's what I try to do, and I think that's what people who are very concerned about this try to do, based on their experience, based on how they read the current situation, what people are really in favor of. As far as market concentration is concerned, count me as among those who never wants to see strong market concentration in any industry. The idea of getting effective competition is critically important. And one of the things that one of the reasons I favor so much the idea of going to an exchange system is that it opens up vastly new choices for people, not just for employers per se, but for people who work in, who are employees, just as the FEHBP offers the kind of choices to federal employees that most of us in the private sector only dream of. In other words, there are plenty of devices and ways of setting up markets to ensure that there is strong competition, and I absolutely favor doing that. The idea that you can do this by setting up a public system, however, a public program is the way of breaking up concentrations in some ways, not what I think is the right way to go, for all the reasons that I've mentioned, and because, as I said, the strongest one of which being that I don't believe you will, in fact, get a true breakup of concentration with a true level playing field degree of competition between those different players. I just think that's inconceivable in the way in which the political process actually operates.
I don't know that you'd break up the concentration. I suspect you wouldn't, but I think you would have the ability of a strong player on the buying side to deal with it. And I think that's, at this point, all we can really hope for. I think, as I've said, I think private insurers would consolidate and get stronger, too, and I think we need that. In terms of predicting, I mean, you know, the future, go back to probabilities, Stuart. I mean, like, would you have predicted 20 years ago or 15 years ago that Medicaid would largely be run by private insurance companies that were contracted by the government, and Medicare has moved now in that direction, that the, you know, that what was a fee-for-service system with government setting rates would essentially lead to, inevitably, the entrance of private private plans? I mean, maybe you would have. I don't know. But I think it's hard to predict.
Karen?
I just wanted to, although you didn't invite it, just a question about consolidation. In the provider community in particular, I think John is right. There are a number of markets where it is very, very difficult to negotiate. The question is, do you drop to an administered pricing system to deal with that, or are there other factors? We've thought about somewhere in between, which is to say that in markets where you simply can't negotiate because there's such scale on the part of particular facilities, to say that if the price quoted on behalf of all of those facilities were more than X percent, 110% of fee-for-service, 115, pick your X, then immediately that those individual hospitals would have to negotiate individually. That would open up the market in a way that would then get that kind of negotiation out there. And I'm sure there are other strategies, but that, since you invited some speculation and discussion about, that would be a way of beginning to open things up. The other issue is must-have entities, must-have physician groups, and we see some of the same kinds of effects, and you could handle it in similar kinds of, using similar kinds of remedies. California, in its discussion of healthcare reform, tried to lay down some of these concepts. They weren't accepted, but I think as part of healthcare reform here, we need to look closely at this. We also need to look closely at, in the name of IT, and some of the activity around IT, is that leading to more consolidation and integration, and will it be even more difficult to negotiate? So we have to have some metrics, A, to look at that, and policy remedies, which we have a number of thoughts about as well.
Okay, we've just about come to the end of our time here, and I don't want to abuse the privilege of your presence. We've had, unfortunately, not nearly enough time to discuss the questions that many of you put very thoughtfully onto these cards, and they're thoughtful questions. We may just circulate the text of those questions to our panelists, and if they have a chance to respond, we'll be happy to record those and circulate those answers as well. I want to take this chance, and I do want to remind you that next Monday we'll be talking about another connected piece of this, the so-called connector exchange proposal that's on the table, and we'd love to hear you back, have you back here for that conversation as well. Please fill out your evaluation forms as you listen to me thank some people, notably Karen Davis and the Commonwealth Fund for their support and participation in both the meeting and the planning of the meeting. Thank you for showing up and making this an interesting and lively conversation, and ask you to join me in thanking our panel for a very thoughtful examination of a tough issue. Thanks to all.